Well, we've looked at the statistics of world poverty, and they're dreadful, and we've looked at some of the causes. But we mustn't delude ourselves into thinking that poverty is really a new problem. Because it isn't. It's always been there. It was there in the days of Jesus, and it was there in the days of Moses. Of course, there are some modern ethical issues about which the Bible says nothing directly, because they are peculiarly contemporary. We'll be looking at one of them next week when we talk about molecules and the value of life and so on. But poverty isn't one of those. And because it isn't, there's an immense amount of material in both the Old Testament and the New Testament which helps us to try and think through our Christian response to it. And my task just in these closing few minutes is to make a few suggestions in that direction. Let me speak first of all about a personal response to poverty. There are many things in the Bible which challenge us to respond to the problem of poverty as we see it in an individual way. For instance, there's much in the Bible about charity, simple charity. It begins in the Old Testament, where Moses says, "Give generously to the poor man and without a grudging heart." There's an immense amount of encouragement there. In fact, people were commanded to set aside a tenth of their income for that purpose. And there's very similar teaching and practice in the example and the teaching of Jesus in the New Testament. It's quite clear that Jesus told us to give alms and personally did so. That when one turns to the early church, one sees that they were sometimes extravagantly generous in the way in which they ministered to one another's needs in this area. So simple charity is where we start, if you like, when one talks about personal response to the problem of poverty. Each of us ought to be setting aside a proportion of our income regularly to help people who are poorer than we are. In fact, one can go a bit further than that, because there is challenge, particularly in the New Testament, that suggests that in order to free ourselves to be able to give generously, it may be important for us to give consideration to our lifestyle. Jesus said, "Sell your possessions and give to the poor." And there wasn't just a particular commandment given to a particular rich young man. In the Gospel of Luke chapter 12, it seems to be a much more general commandment given to his disciples. Now, of course, we have to be careful taking a text like that. It could be pushed to the limit of a kind of ascetic ideal, where all of us should embrace voluntary poverty. And there have been groups in the history of the church that have interpreted Jesus that way. One thinks of Francis of Assisi as a classic example, and in some ways a very attractive example. But one couldn't really say that that kind of extreme of simple lifestyle is what the New Testament generally has in mind. In fact, pushed to extreme, it would deny the Christian doctrine of creation. St. Paul tells us everything God has made is good and it's there for us to enjoy. Whilst it may be perfectly true that Jesus did practice a very simple lifestyle and probably was very generous himself to the poor, it's also true to say that he occasionally got the reputation of being a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. So it's unlikely that even Jesus himself would have denied us every luxury simply because it was a luxury, or made an ideal of poverty in that kind of naive way. In fact, there was one occasion you may remember when he created 120 gallons of the best quality of wine to help celebrate a wedding. Hardly the act of a Francis of Assisi, I think. Again, the New Testament challenges us also on the whole level of community when it comes to freeing ourselves to be charitable. For in the early church, they weren't just individuals who each made a contribution from their own personal income. They thought about relieving poverty in a corporate way. They shared everything they had, we read. Now again, that can be pushed too far. It's important to realize that that communalism of the early church wasn't communism, for it was voluntary. There was nothing compulsory about it at all. In fact, you could say it was capitalistic charity, because it was an example of free men doing as they wished with their own property. And the book of Acts makes that quite clear. So those who want to see in the communalism of the early church some endorsement for some kind of extreme forms of communism or socialistic sharing, I think have to look again. But there is a profound challenge there in the early church, in the way that they felt responsible for one another in their local community. Indeed, that sense of responsibility spilled over internationally too. So that we find Paul, in his second letter to the Corinthians, urging them to make a collection, not for the poor of their own community, but for the poor who lived 1,000 miles away in Jerusalem. In all these ways, then, a personal response is required of us, a charitable response, and that may involve us simplifying our lifestyle in order that we may have more resources to share. It may involve us taking more responsibility in the community that we belong to, the church, or thinking more sensitively about the needs of churches overseas, so that a sense of social concern characterizes our actions, and not just a legalistic setting aside of 10%. However, a personal response on its own isn't enough to solve the problem of world poverty, or even to discharge our Christian conscience in regard to it. Thomas Malthus, in the 18th century, was one of the first men to study seriously the growth of population. And he came to a very famous conclusion as a result of his studies. He pointed out that since population tends to grow by geometric progression, and economic production tends to grow by arithmetic progression, economic disaster lies ahead for the world. He was a pessimist of all pessimists. And he stood over against the utopian optimism that was in vogue in his day by saying that to feed the hungry, in fact, was counterproductive. It only encourages them to breed more, he said, and so multiplies the problems of shortage. Now, that seems a very callous thing to say, and there is no doubt that Malthus did grossly oversimplify the problem. He didn't allow for advances in science. He didn't allow for the fact that as economic development proceeds, generally speaking, population rates tend to drop. But there is enough of a germ of truth in what Malthus said to mean that it is still taken seriously by some people today, the neo-Malthusians, as they sometimes call themselves. And there are those today who criticize mercilessly those of us who simply hand out charity to the poor, saying that all we are doing is increasing those hungry masses and making the problem that the next generation will have to face even larger. It may sound sadistic and cruel to say it is to the advantage of poor nations to have a high death rate, but in a sense, that may be so. What it means, I think, for us is not that we should be neo-Malthusians and stop giving to charity. That would be a disgraceful thing to do, and it certainly wouldn't be endorsed by the Bible. But what it does mean is that we have to go beyond mere personal response. We have to think, too, about structural response. The ultimate answer for the poor of the world is not that they should live on the charity of those who have more than enough. The ultimate answer for the poor of the world is that they should be able to feed themselves. But that brings in the whole question of economics. How do you enable a people, a society, to economically develop from a position of penury to one where they are economically self-sufficient? How does economic development happen? Now, there are two ways, you see, that people have tended to think about this. If you think of the wealth of a society like as a cake, some people have said, well, the answer to poor societies is to help them to increase the size of their cake. Then there'll be more for everybody. If the cake gets bigger, there'll be more for the poor. That tends to have been the response of right-wing thinkers, right-wing economists. The other general response has been to say, no, we shouldn't think about increasing the size of the cake, because after all, if you increase the size of the cake but it all goes into one mouth, you haven't achieved anything for the poor. We should think about the distribution of the cake, cutting it into more equal pieces. And that has tended to be the response of left-wing economists and thinkers. To give them the labels we're all familiar with, there's capitalism and socialism. Capitalism is very good at making the cake bigger. It's not terribly good at cutting the cake up in more equal-sized pieces. Socialism, on the other hand, is very good at distributing the cake, at least in theory it is, but history has proven that it's very weak on increasing it. Thus, for instance, where poor nations have tried to embrace a right-wing, a capitalistic system of growth in their economy, though the wealth of the nation, the gross national product, may have increased phenomenally, there may still be huge problems of poverty there. Because all that extra wealth is possessed by an elite who live in the cities, in big houses, and running big cars. On the other hand, those countries that have embraced a socialist, left-wing kind of philosophy of economic development, they haven't got out of the poverty trap either. Because, generally speaking, you find that they simply haven't found the dynamic, the drive, the incentive which is necessary to make people produce more wealth. They may be equal, but generally speaking, they're all equally poor. When I was living in East Africa, there's a classic example of it. Kenya, where I was living, was basically a capitalistic country with huge polarizations between rich and poor, though a very successful record of economic development. Tanzania, next door, was a classical example of socialistic development and was bankrupt. In fact, even the large socialistic countries are bankrupt. Russia, with a sixth of the world's land surface at its disposal and 10% of its vast labor force in agricultural production, still can't grow enough wheat to feed itself. East Anglia grows 100 times more wheat per acre than they manage to produce in Russia. And it's not simply because the quality of soil is better. Same goes for China. I expect you've heard this week how China is adopting reversionist policies in order to try and overcome the devastating economic effects of the Cultural Revolution. So you see, the world doesn't really have the answer on this structural question. We have right-wing thinkers that are very good at making the cake bigger, but very poor at splitting it up in the right way, and we have left-wing theories that are pretty good at distributive justice, but pretty hopeless when it comes to material incentives. Is there any way we as Christians can make a response in that area, an area which is very theoretical and certainly way beyond anything as individuals that we can do, because it can't be a personal response. We're talking now about the whole way societies are organized, the way they run their economies. But is there a contribution we can make? Well, you know, what both capitalism and socialism have neglected fundamentally is the fallenness of man. That's the root weakness of their theories. Capitalism fails to check human covetousness. So nice as it may be in theory to say, well, when we've got the bigger cake, there'll be all those nice rich people who will hand it out and be kind to their employees and generous to their peasants and what have you. It doesn't work that way. People are greedy and selfish, and capitalism plays into their hands by concentrating wealth in the hands of the few who do not share it. On the other hand, socialism is weak for similar reasons. Not that it fails to check covetousness, but that it fails to allow for the fact that human beings are by nature lazy and indolent and will get away with doing the least work they can, unless they are given very strong incentives to do otherwise. We all know that's true of ourselves. Multiply that on the level of a huge nation, and you find a whole nation that cannot grow economically because nobody's sufficiently motivated to put the work in. And that's what happens in lots and lots of socialist countries in this world. Basically, then, it's the fall of man. It's sin, which the theoreticians are not taking into account sufficiently seriously. But in the Bible, we do find a structure devised for a nation which did take sin very much into account. Thinking of Old Testament Israel. It's worth looking at the structure of Old Testament Israel much more seriously. Because, you see, at least in my judgment, they managed to get the balance right between distributive justice and material incentives. There is a stroke of divine genius in the way that the economy of ancient Israel was organized. You see, on the one hand, you could say, from the perspective of the capitalist, that it was a free market economy. There was private property, there was no wealth tax, there was no nationalization of land, there was no planned economy. A man could keep everything he earned other than his 10% income tax and pass it on to his children. Very capitalistic, you might say. But looked at from the perspective of the socialist, that Old Testament law put a huge emphasis on distributive justice too. Because, you see, there could be no landless families in Israel. Land couldn't be bought and sold. It was distributed evenly amongst all the families of the nation, irrevocably, inalienably. They could never sell it. It had to belong to that nation in perpetuity, into that family in perpetuity. So that every family had land. There could be no such thing as a landless peasant. What's more, there could be no debt in Israel, because the interest rate was set by law at 0%. We'd all like to buy cars at that rate, wouldn't we? Now, Ben was saying earlier that those two things, landlessness and debt, indebtedness to the moneylender, are the two things that cripple agrarian countries and the peasantry there. Such things were ruled out by the very structure of Old Testament Israel. Now, without doubt, there was a price to pay in terms of inefficiency, because small businesses and small firms would be the order of the day in ancient Israel. There could be no big businesses, no big firms, no big farms, because the land was divided up evenly amongst the people. But that minor inefficiency, it seems, is a small price to pay for achieving a measure of distributive justice without sacrificing material incentives in the process. And that seems to be the balance which God in his wisdom settled for when he sought to devise an economic structure for a fallen world. And it may be, as Christians, we should be thinking about that far more seriously and making far more concrete contributions to the debate about economic development in our day from a biblical basis.